Morning, everybody.
Morning.
We've just started on Tuesday nights giving the latest round of Way Seeking Mind Talks. And these are individual Sangha members who share their journey, their spiritual unfolding journey. The unfolding of the mind that seeks the way in each of us, and how our lives plopped us into this way. Long before we ever knew there was a way, long before we ever heard of Buddhism, or whatever other stream of practice we've taken up. And there are a number of people here who've practiced in a couple of different traditions. But we all have that. Everybody here has a story to tell. And what's very interesting about giving repeated way-seeking mind talks is that we notice that our story always changes. And that, especially when we get to the age that I am, which some of us are at, there's endless stories to be told. And it's a challenge to decide what details to extract, even in the unfolding of our spiritual self. So I'll do my best. So today's my turn. And I guess the last time I gave a talk was about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. I was in a very, very different place in relation to practice than I am now. So we'll all discover what I say. I made a list. I didn't want to write it out. I made it a list. And just to help me remember some of the chronology. But it really takes a lot to become a mature human being. And we all have helpers along the way that just appear. Some are born into we're all born into, the lore is we're all born into the perfect family for our own spiritual unfolding. It may not seem that way. And it certainly for many years didn't seem that way to me. I had a very difficult early life. So I was born on the hottest day of 1947. And when my mother went into labor, she was in a movie theater keeping cool. It was air conditioned. My parents lived in the Bronx, which is the northernmost borough of New York City. And I was the second child born to them, and later they had two more. So I have an older sister who's 3 years older, who was very put out by my appearance. And that's been a lifelong theme, which has been a very important motivator for my practice and a very important indicator of my practice, where I'm at, depending on how I would respond to some of our interactions. Anyway, so both my parents were artists. My father's a sculptor, my mother's a poet, and they were both professors. So there was a lot of strong educational themes and expectation to, I don't know about whether it's succeed, but to express oneself in a very original fashion, is all I can say. That was a big theme in my growing up. And I grew up on Long Island, which is just east of New York City, during the Eisenhower and Kennedy years. I was a child. And in the suburbs, but my parents were both really independent, and especially my father was a real iconoclast. So he was always at odds with his colleagues at the school and his colleagues in the New York art world. And that dominated the life. So actually, both my parents were artists. They're very gifted. And who knows why they had four children. I mean, and all of us kids growing up wondered, how is it that they even bothered? Because that was not their central interest. Although now, I really appreciate having had them as parents. I'll get to some of that perhaps later. But we didn't have any kind of our religion was kind of independent, thinking independently, and atheism. My mother was a virulent atheist. And my father was a Jew, a cultural Jew, a Jew in a family that really rejected him. So we never went anywhere near a temple, but I grew up in an area of Long Island that was strongly Jewish, and I had a lot of Jewish friends, and so I really soaked that up. And my grandparent, especially my grandmother, my grandfather died when I was about six, but my grandmother was alive during much of my early life, and barely spoke English. She was from Poland, and she spoke Yiddish and Polish, was a fabulous cook, as opposed to my mother, who expressed her dismay at the housewife role. Well, she wasn't really a housewife, but by not really being into cooking particularly. So actually, I remember as a very young child, I loved going to my grandmother's for one reason, which is the food was great. And her love of cooking was terrific. I mean, her blithe spirit, her tremendous joy when she would be cooking and presenting food. And I think that I inherited that from her, because that's always been one of my great joys. So my father was a metal sculptor, always had a studio, and I was kind of his little puppy. I mean, I've always been a person who listened, a second child, paying attention, right? My sister, very accomplished and very on her own, gonna be the leader kind of thing. But I followed my father around. One, I loved him. He loved me, but also I was afraid of him because he had an incredible temper, but he had a very, very strong personality. But anyway, what happened was I spent a lot of my childhood in his studio while he was making metal sculptures, and he talked to me about the process of creating. And so really one of the habits that I got into was listening closely to somebody else's process. So I see that as one of the early part of the formation of me as a therapist. And also understanding the artistic process. I think I have a kind of an insight, especially through my father. That was one thing that he gave me. And I went to some of his college classes and we listened to him teach. And I was incredibly shy as a young child. I mean, painfully shy. And so I kind of lurk in the back shadow of the classroom while he gave his lectures and wonder at how relaxed he seemed in front of the class. And so I think that also has been a theme in my life, how to come forward from my extreme self-consciousness. In the family that I grew up in, there was a lot of conflict. My parents never got along. My father was unfaithful often. And I was aware of it as a very young child, and so I was always in kind of a bind. And also there was a lot of fighting, there was a lot of violence in the family, and acting out, and paranoia, and scary stuff. So I found myself really wondering where I came from, because everybody, my siblings, my parents were very involved in all of the drama that was going on. And I always felt like I was looking on and wondering, where did I come from? So for a long time, I thought I was adopted. And then one day during a Rahatsu Sesshin, many years later, during a meditation, I put a couple of things together, which was when I was two, I got pneumonia right after my little brother was born, one of my brothers. And I was in the hospital I always thought at 6 weeks. My mother in recent years said, no, you were in the hospital for 2 weeks. But my mother had a preemie baby at home, so I was not visited very much. And so, you know, at age two, that's a pretty serious interruption of faith. And when I got out of the hospital, I had asthma, and I had asthma my whole life. So that meant that I spent a lot of nights in my life having to pay attention to getting each breath. And it was at that moment during Rahatsu that I realized, oh, I started meditating when I was two. And, you know, that kind of demonstrates how the Dharma, the the Dharma, the Tao, is always operating whether we realize it or not. And what a terrible thing for a young child to have asthma, but what a blessing it was for me to have asthma. Because it was the basis for my thriving in my life. You know, at this point I feel like I've really had a life that has continually become more and more thriving. So it also makes me look be so appreciative of how it's true that things that are point of view is just a point of view, and there's no absolute about, you know, something happens and we think how terrible. But on the other hand, if you have awareness and awareness of awareness, it becomes the very source of liberation and happiness. So growing up in that family where all kinds of things were going on, I very often would go to school almost shaking from the stuff that happened in the morning before I went to school. And if any of you grew up with profound trauma at home, you probably know what I'm referring to. So by the time I was 18, I remember there was a particular moment. I was so screwed up. And I thought, I am never going to survive unless I figure something out. How am I going to survive? So it was like, it was the beginning of a prayer, a beginning of realizing that I was going to very intentionally be open to something that would help me get stabilized and sort stuff out. So my first koan in my life was, what makes people tick? And also, where do I come from? You know, these were my original koans. So this is really what way-seeking minds help us do, is kind of look into, in this particular way, into what are sources in this life. So I had to get out of there. I went to college. I finished high school early. I started college when I was 16, which was really overwhelming, but it was also getting out of the house, which was good. And then I went to school, dropped out, went back. But in that process, I met somebody who was very, and got married when I was 20. Very stable, very kind, very stable, intellectual person, solid. And that marriage, even though I thought that was an issue for me in my life, and it has been in various ways, I realized that, no, that was a really skillful thing to do. I was lucky, because that person really helped me out. And actually, his sister is still an extremely close friend of mine. The twists and turns of karma, you know. We met each other through her brother, and then through me, she started Zen practice and met her husband of 50, 40 years, 30 years, something like that. So together we moved out to Seattle for him to go to graduate school and for us to get away from New York. And when I got to Seattle, I started doing TM. I got a job at a shelter for runaway girls, and there was another person working there who was doing TM and completely enthralled by it. So I took my handkerchief and my orange and went to an initiation and got my mantra. And I found it very intriguing because it mobilized kind of my mystery mind. But it didn't really help me out because there was no teaching that. So it kind of drifted away, but I still felt as though I was on a spiritual path. At that point I realized I was on a spiritual path. And I started studying. I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, so I started studying Romanian at UW. I wanted to translate. I thought be a technical translator, but in Catalan. But Catalan was discontinued that year, and Romanian was taught. So I took Romanian. I'd taken a lot of 4 years of Latin and a whole bunch of French. So it was it's a Romance language. And then I went to Romania, and so I was away from my husband for 3 months while I was in Romania. I was in Cluj, which is the capital of Transylvania, Beautiful, beautiful place. And this was during Ceausescu's time, so it was still very much a communist, very intriguing. And I won't go into the details, but there are some great stories from that time. But anyway, when I got back, I knew I couldn't go back into the marriage because I had been on my own for 3 months, and I was just I felt so inspired and so alive, and the intellectual aspect of things was not interesting to me any longer. And then I took a poetry class, and I fell for somebody else, and that was that. So at the age of 27, I got a divorce. And that was a really rich time for spiritual opening, because I also was diagnosed with thyroid cancer right at the same time. And when my husband and I split up, only one friend stuck with me. Everybody else kind of went with him. So I was really alone. And then I had this diagnosis, and it was the first time that I thought, oh, I could die now. And so I was in total panic, and I had gotten married to help me stabilize, so suddenly I had to do that work on my own, and it was very, very tentative. I felt very tentative, very scared. And there was a day when I was working at the university library at UW, and I thought, I just can't even face my life anymore. So I felt like I was going to kill myself. So I took a break from work and went out into Red Square to think about what I was going to do. And I couldn't bear the agony that was contained in that contemplation. But all I could think of to do was to pray, and I had never prayed in my life. So I raised my hands to the sky. It was like 2 in the afternoon. Maybe it was November. The wind was blowing. The sky was gray. You know, that's the whole thing. And I prayed, help. Help me. I don't know what to do. Help. Send me some help. And then right at that moment, across the Red Square, this huge whirlwind came up. And it started, wow. You know, when it picks up leaves and dust, and it just started picking stuff up. And in that swirl was this big yellow thing, which kept coming closer and closer to me. And it dropped right in front of me and opened up, and it was a McDonald's hamburger container, styrofoam. And I just felt so relieved. I don't know what this is, but thank you. Because it was so silly. Oh, it was great. So then, within maybe that day or the next day, I was shelving books, and a book fell on my nose. And it was Born in Tibet by Chogyam Trungpa, who was a Tibetan master. So I started reading that book. I actually just got it again to read it again, thinking that I was going to be doing this. And when I read it, I thought, oh, wow, this is really what I want to look into here. But there were no Tibetan groups in Seattle at that time. But there was a Zen group at in the art building at UW. So I went, and I began to sit, and I also began to do yoga that same week. And that was the beginning. And from the first sit, I sat down. I had no idea. No instruction was given. I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing. But I sat down in the smell of the oil paints in the studio, an art studio, right? I mean, I really felt at home. And I just felt like myself. It's like, oh, okay, this is home. And I never questioned it. I've never questioned it. I never had to, is this my way? I've had moments, but basically it wasn't an intellectual decision. It wasn't a decision. It was just what happened. During that time, what time is it? I'm probably going to have to cut this short.
It's about 25 after.
So that was the Seattle Zen Center that I was sitting with. We didn't have a teacher at the time. We had a number of people come visit. The guy who led it was an art history professor who has since become a Roshi. But he brought, one day he came to the sit, Wednesday night sits, and he said, okay, I want everybody to show up on Sunday at the Zen House because we're going to have a really terrific guest. You've never heard of him. He's called the Dalai Lama. Please come, because he's really an extraordinary human being. So we all went, oh, okay, we'll come. So we came to the Zen House, and, you know, 25 of us sat around with the Dalai Lama for 2 hours and had tea and talked. And, you know, and the next time I saw him, there were 600 or 800 people, and then the next time there were 10,000 people, and the next time there were 20,000, you know. So that was his first visit to this country, to Seattle. We did Sesshin. The Seattle Zen Center had a priest who was the meditation master at a Heiji temple in Japan. And he would come over once or twice a year and lead Sesshin on Vashon Island. So those were my first experiences. I did my first 7-day Sesshin 3 months after I started sitting. It really blew me away. It was really hard. But when I left, I got a ride downtown Seattle and was waiting at the bus stop, and I felt like I could tell what everybody was thinking. And it was just a matter of, I was quiet and I was seeing, you know. It was really interesting. And then after the first Sesshin, that week, Osho-san was going to the McNeil Island Penitentiary to lead a sit with prisoners. So I went out with several other people with him. And I had an enormous opening during that time. I sat. It was really scary to be in there. You know, we were in this locked room. I could hear the next door to the gym, and they were playing basketball. And my legs were killing me so much, and I thought, I can't move. So I just had to dig down deep and quiet and into the most, you know, search for the place in myself that I could take refuge in, really, to relax and not totally freak out. And then I just, everything stopped. And I'd never had an experience of my mind stopping before. And it was really very calming, and very inspiring. And for years after that, it ruined my meditation because I tried to get back to it. So even though I was, you know, we warn each other, don't try to get something again. That's, when you have these wonderful moments, they are to be enjoyed and let go of. Anyway, so then after several years, 3 or 4 years, we were going to have a visit from the first American Zen master, Eiken Roshi, on a Wednesday night. And knowing that was happening, anyway, I had a dream one night, which was an extraordinary dream, that I woke from thinking, well, that wasn't a dream. And then when Eiken Roshi walked in the room, he was the person in the dream. And so I began to, I mean, immediately I thought, oh, okay, well, he's my teacher. And he mentioned that there was going to be a 3-month training at the Maui Zendo, so I immediately signed up for that and attended the Maui Zendo. And during that 3 months, I kind of reclaimed a sense of rhythm in my life, because we had a very patterned existence, as you do in the monastery. It's one of the benefits from spending some residential time in a monastery. You really connect with the rhythm of waking, resting, activity, you know, and it was very wonderful. As well as Eiken Roshi is just such a terrific, kind, safe, smart guy, and he was very, and a political activist, which was very appealing to me. And he got me involved with the Stop Trident campaign, when we got in front of the first Trident subs, that the nuclear subs that came down Puget Sound, and that was quite the I don't know, quite a mixture of Dharma practice and activism and just being really engaged. And one of the things we did with Aiken Roshi was we took canoed to the land right opposite from the Trident base, and we were going to canoe over as part of the actions. There were all kinds of actions going on. And first we walked back and forth on the beach there chanting the Heart Sutra for a while. And that's when I learned the Heart Sutra, actually, in Japanese, was that particular walk back and forth. And during that action, I met Mark, who was my second husband and father of my children. And we were mightily attracted to each other and did a great job of having kids and raising kids the first few years, but we were never could live comfortably with each other. We were at odds, kind of the way my parents had been. So that ended. We're still fine friends, and it was just not, the relationship was not to be with each other, it was more to have children and to be family. We have a family relationship, a very strong family relationship. When the kids were little, or Misha was born, I was always doing retreats and meditation. I've always done it since the first time I began. And I read an article in the Ten Directions, which was the Zen Center of Los Angeles newsletter, by Chozen in 1983 or 4. And it was about marriage. And I thought, I want to meet her, because it was just so helpful, how to work with conflict in intimate relationships using practice. So when I saw that she was leading a retreat at Cloud Mountain, I signed up for that. So that was I think the first time I did sesshin with her, I was pregnant with Rosie, so it was 1988. And it was terrific, too, because Aiken Roshi was in Maui. The Seattle Zen Center had broken up because of all kinds of things that happened when Takabayashi Genki Roshi came. He should be down there. I don't think he's in the dedication. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful teacher also, but he was like a kid in a candy shop coming from a lifelong residence in a monastery in Japan, and he came here with all these beautiful young women in the Sangha, and he just could not contain himself. So the center split up, but everybody who was sitting at that time continues to, and there are four teachers that were part of that group, including the abbot of the Zen Center of Los Angeles. Okay, so where am I? So, studying with Chozen, I had, you know, when I met her, so I had been practicing for, I don't know, 13 or 14 years when I met her, 15 years. And practicing in traditions that, except for Aiken Roshi when I was at the Maui Zendo, he taught Dharma. But other than that, I never received teachings. And so coming to practice with somebody who is such a fine teacher and so concerned with transmitting all of, you know, of opening up this wealth of material from 2,600 years, and also encouraging us to study that, be supported in that, have reference to that when we need it, but also to really look into our own experience as our guide, as the Buddha said, you know, be a guide unto yourself. And it's really what he did. You know, the story of the Buddha's life, that's the first way-seeking mind, or the one we have access to. And what he remembered, I mean, if you remember that story, if you've heard this, that after he had followed other teachers for 6 years or something and become near death from all the privations that he had thought were going to lead him to awakening, not quite knowing what awakening would be. He had a memory. After this hurting girl gave him some milk and restored him, and he was starting to feel a little better, and he was taking care of his body, he remembered when he was 2 years old that he was set out on a blanket under a rose apple tree while the village, including his father, the king, the headsman, were out plowing the fields. And he remembered his first samadhi, which was just sitting there and being one with the day and the sounds and the birds and the, you know. And that, when I first heard that story, I remembered when I was, three, I used to spend a lot of time in the garden, squatting in the amongst the vegetables and the flowers, and just looking at the bees and looking at all the little flying, I mean, there were lots of little flying critters to be seen, and being absolutely in the moment. And that was what he remembered. And I thought, well, there's something in that that I have not been paying attention to. Could it be that simple? And what else do I want to say about it? So I now feel I received transmission last year, Sangha transmission, which means that it's kind of an acknowledgement that I really can trust my own experience and use it as a source to encourage all of you to trust your own experience. And also, even and just as important, to look through all of the things that create the experience of self. You know, one of the things that we could say characterizes the experience of self is it's separate. And we do, you know, we're all separate. And we're all alone in our lives, really. But that's from the relative point of view. So it's true, we are separate. Nobody knows what somebody asked me yesterday, what do you experience when you meditate? How could I ever say, what do you experience when you meditate? You know, nobody can know that for us. One wonderful Zen teacher, and I've quoted him a number of times because I like this, that he says, nobody can fart for you. Nobody can burp for you. Nobody can poop for you. Right? And nobody can meditate for you. We all need to find what is our truest nature. Not the things that all the things we identify ourselves as, our roles, our bodies, our looks, our weight, our education, all these things, they're all part of us. They're the human life. And they are of great value and importance to pay attention to and to work with skill. But also everything about us is co-created, and every way that I use my life has had an impact. You know, everybody who I've come across has impacted my own clear mind or foggy mind or heart in pain or heart open or, you know. And we all, in this practice allows us to just sit down and come back to the simplicity of who we are apart from all of that stuff. So that when we address the conditions of our lives, we can come at it with our whole heart and not fooling ourselves that we are the center of the universe. We are, and we're not. So, you know, I remember Kyogen Carlson gave this wonderful talk. It was during one of the first Rohatsu Sesshins where we all collaborated up at Great Vow. And he said the greatest teaching of the Buddhas is the middle way. And I never had that pointed out before, but ever since, it's been a really important reminder that it is, it's true. You know, we have our individual, and yet we're all part of an organism. And to be always aware of what we're choosing, and it's the effects we can know, and mostly we don't know the effects of what we choose. So anyway, I could go blab on and on, but I think that's about it. So do we have 5 minutes for a couple of questions?
It's about 20 till.
Okay, we do. So usually with Way-Seeking Mind Talks, then you open it up for questions. So if anybody has any comments or questions, now's the time.
Just a comment. When you said that about how you realized when you were 2 years old that you had had a kensho or an awakening experience, then I remembered one of mine, and so that was so cool. Thank you so much. It like brought up some of my way-seeking mind. I loved it. So I want to thank you for that.
So the time you were in the Red Square in the McDonald's container. What did that say to you? What did you take from that? Because you were in a very desperate place, and then did you just walk away and went to McDonald's and got a Big Mac or something?
No. Never been to McDonald's. Yeah. No, I just laughed, which really helped. So I was like, I mean, I was so lost in my suffering. Mm-hmm. And the levity of that, and the playfulness of it, and the and that it answered a prayer. I never prayed before, and then this is my answer. But it was exactly right. Perfect.
Have it your way.
you were expecting maybe a leaflet that was going to say, come to the Zen Center. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, Leslie.
I was wondering, what's it like for you when you meditate?
It's probably like it's like for all of us when we all meditate. It's it's different now because I'm more relaxed now than I used to be when I meditate, and I don't try to make anything happen, usually. The mind bubbles around the first 10 minutes or so, or 20 minutes, and then I allow the thought to come up that this is not to be wasted with general chatter, not to get involved, and so I steer myself back to resting very deeply. And the other thing is that and this is why I urge everybody to do retreat, when you have long periods of meditation, you cannot help but let go of stuff. It just happens. I mean, think of when you go camping, you know, after 4 or 5 days, you come back and you're pretty quiet. And you can have these experiences that really are such a relief, and they're so body, they so involve body release they have for me, that I can just call it up. So I don't always have to start from the very beginning. So that's just a few comments. What's it like for you when you meditate?
It's hard to describe. I mean, how do you describe when someone burps?
Well, we should all have a poetic assignment to describe a burp. North?
So, it seems like I remember you saying in the past that you did have times in your life where you really were wondering whether continuing to do Zen practice was the right thing for you. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what made you keep doing it?
That I knew that it was natural. It's not anything I could give up. And that actually what it would do is it would drive me to my own practice rather than looking to whoever was my teacher at the time who was giving me. I was having issues about how the Dharma was being expressed or something. So it just, I'd come back to, you know, I'm gonna stop doing this, and I'd think, well, how can I possibly stop doing this? It was absurd to think I could drop Zen practice, because Zen practice would not drop me. So I just brought it home and thought, okay, I'll just do my own practice and not worry about that so much. And also there were times, I mean, I have practiced very, very steadily, but there have been, especially when my kids were little, times when I put it down. And actually Rosie, my younger one, got me back to regular practice when she was 4 by solving this problem in her lovely, sweet way. Because bedtime stories were growing, you know, first one story, then 2 stories, then 3 stories. If you've been with young kids or dogs, maybe that's what happens. They just start. And finally, I said, you know, I have to meditate. And you want me to meditate, I assure you, but I can't do it because I fall asleep if I read lots and lots of stories at night. So she said, well, why don't you just I don't need the story, but I do need you by me. So why don't you just meditate by my bed? So that's what I started doing.
Oh, cool.
And that's when I got back to it. And the other thing, and a lot of you have heard this story, but at that time I was chanting the Metta Sutra before I began my practice. And I hadn't learned it. I was still reading it. And then, so I'd chant it and then I'd meditate. And then after about a month of this, Rosie started chanting with me one night. She had learned it just from my chanting it every night. She knew it by heart. I was still reading it. So at that point I thought, okay, I have to learn this by heart. But she has continued a chanting practice ever since. So thank you all for listening. And may everybody's practice be a treasure in your lives.